Tonight on Arena, TV reviews including The Iris Affair, Leonard and Hungry Paul and Mr. Scorsese, and we look at new albums from The Last Dinner Party, Chrissie Hynde and Bro Gale. And welcome along to Friday Night's Arena, 51551. If you would like to text us, as usual, arena at rte.ie is the email address. And you can find us on Instagram at rte_arena. Tonight we start with TV reviews, as always on a Friday. Sky brings us a new thriller, The Iris Affair, which has been autocorrecting to The Irish Affair on everybody's documents all day, in which an enigmatic genius, Iris Nixon, played by Niamh Algar, is enticed by Tom Hollander's charismatic entrepreneur Cameron Beck to solve an unsolvable puzzle, but then flees from him and a tense chase across Italy ensues. In Leonard and Hungry Paul, a gentle BBC comedy drama series adapted from Ronan Hessian's best-selling novel and narrated by Julia Roberts, two friends, Leonard, played by Alex Lawther, a ghostwriter of children's encyclopedias dealing with his mother's death, and Hungry Paul, Laurie Kinnaston, is a part-time postman dreading his sister's wedding. Finally for tonight, Apple TV's Mr. Scorsese. It is a big, shiny, five-part documentary series directed by Rebecca Miller and delves into Martin Scorsese's extraordinary life and career using intimate interviews with himself and luminaries like Robert De Niro, Leonardo DiCaprio and Steven Spielberg. Jess, let me start that again one more time, because I've made Jen and Chris into one person. Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser, who are two entirely separate people, have watched all three and join me now. Before we start, it is The Iris Affair from Sky. I'm going to play this from the very opening scene. Here we go.
Camera, don't be preposterous.
Miss Brooke,
calm down. Everything is fine.
Everything's all fine!
Come on, Iris!
Pull the trigger or don't. Nothing changes.
Miss Brooke!
Infinity minus one, Joy. Don't be afraid.
Oh, that is such bullshit. Joy, it's just a position she takes. Even she doesn't believe it.
I can assure you she very much does. Please don't kill me. It's broken.
She's right, I commit. You do it.
And that is Iris, Niamh Algar, trying to handle an angry Cameron who is threatening Joy with a gun. Tom Hollander's Cameron and Mariana Tomlinson playing Joy. Jen, explain this if you don't mind.
Are you ready for another high concept thriller? Every week we're coming to you with these kind of perplexing, convoluted plots, which I am going to squarely blame on the output of Christopher Nolan. I think we're living in a post-Tenet world, and it's like screenwriters are like, how much plot can I squash into something to make viewers feel like you have a whole load of wire hangers caught in your head and are trying to eke them out slowly. So,
because we should point out to people before we do this, that scene right there is the opening
scene.
Entire series. We're not given any context. We're just thrown straight into it straight there.
Yeah, it's Luther writer Neil Cross. So if you're familiar with his work and the diminishing returns of Luther, because I think what started as this great thriller, neo-noir almost, with Idris Elba swan around and smashing things in his big coat, which I loved, and then descended into a dreadful, forgettable Netflix film, which we will never speak of again. So he is the master of cutting up timelines. So the timeline we're seeing here, you actually don't get to the guts of really until episode 4, where you see it again and it all makes sense to you. So he's splitting up these timelines where you see Iris, who, played by Niamh Algar, who is a puzzle obsessive, you could say, like maybe did one too many wordles, and she has ended up on in true jigs and reels, true doing all these complicated puzzles in Italy. And this is at a huge moment between her meeting up again with Cameron Beck, who is this skeezy venture capitalist played by Tom Hollander, and he wanted her to crack this encrypted code. So we're at this very tense moment where he's like, give me the bag where all the stuff is in for the MacGuffin, or the girl gets it, who is the student that while Iris has been on the run, she's been tutoring. Now, Iris on the run is, I love her disguises. For somebody that there is a £4 million bounty on and these internet sleuths are trying to find her, her disguises range from wearing a bucket hat during the day and throwing on a pair of glasses when she is tutoring Joy. But what the main story is when we flip backwards is we then meet Iris again after she has solved all these puzzles. She's ended up in Italy with Cameron. Cameron basically tells her that by solving all these puzzles, convoluted puzzles, it was actually a job interview. And what he wants her to do is come with her and use her skills that he's been so impressed by throughout Big Puzz, that there is this encrypted activation code that this crazy scientist, oh is there God. Any other kind, has put on the world's most powerful computer, or as they call it, a topological quantum device that is named Charlie Big Potatoes, because why not, guys?
And you're not joking about that.
I wish I was making that up. So he's very fond of this computer, but this computer is like all our fears. It's maybe getting too clever. This thing is growing its own brain and it's kind of out of control. And also the mad scientist wants to destroy it as well. So she gets close enough to like unencrypt this and get this going again, because it's been put to sleep, that there is a tragedy that happens and she escapes with the code and he's chasing after. That's as much as I can do in a succinct way.
Because Chris, Jenna simplified that there, hasn't she? It is more complicated than that.
Yeah, this thing does not tell its story in a straight line. I actually find it strange that Neil Cross has come out in the last couple of weeks. He was speaking to the Radio Times about how when he first brought the Iris affair to Sky, there were no dual timelines. There was no zigzagging across the globe. I think he had written just one flashback episode, episode 4, and then another episode 5 that would introduce a corrupt police force unit in Sardinia. So you would have to wait 3 to 4, maybe 5 hours for the story to kind of, you know, explain itself and to get to the action that we see in that opening scene. And it wasn't until Sky actually commissioned it that they said, no, we're going to need to know more up front. Again, going back to this thing, I feel like we were just talking about it 5 minutes ago, that viewers need to see all the action in the first few minutes or they'll get bored, they'll check out. So he went back and he redesigned the format. He just, you know, he messed around with the puzzle. And he says that he enjoyed it, but unfortunately, when you're watching it, I mean, about 20 minutes into this thing, I was saying to myself, what's going on here? I am very, very confused. So I'm not a fan of this jumping all around the place. I think it spoils momentum. But to be honest, I think that's the least of its problems. There are so many problems here. The Master of Disguise thing, actually, Jen, that annoyed me too, because Rick, at the best of times, I lose my glasses 10 times a day. I would find Niamh Alger's iris like that. I mean, it's just, you need more than a wig. You need more than a change of clothes. That bit is ridiculous. So yeah, the plot is very difficult to explain. This show can be very difficult to keep up with. Performance wise though, Niamh Alger and Tom Hollander, they are working very hard. Mm. Niamh Alger is always a joy. Anytime, you know, she's like, she, unfortunately, she has made some unusual decisions. Anytime she does, they always say, go back and watch Censor. I thought that was fantastic. Mm. But she is good here because she's kind of required to be a little bit strange, a little bit blank. Yeah. She is quite, you know, she's she likes solving puzzles. She is a puzzle herself. So I think she understands the character. And I think Tom Hollander, we're never going to get to see him play a Bond villain, but this is the closest. Should. I mean, he's very good with bad lines, and there are an awful lot of bad lines here.
Okay, I want to play another clip from this. And in the tradition of the show, it is in reverse chronology as well, because the clip we're about to play you occurs later in the first episode, but occurs earlier in the chronology than when... Look, this is it. Iris cracking a series of complex online puzzles, and then it brings her to a piazza in Florence. And this is where she meets Tom Hollander's Cameron Beck for the first time.
I know who you are. I read Wired magazine. Well, actually, I don't, but I know who you are.
Do you know what I do?
Not really. Well, I mean, sort of. You're basically like a venture capitalist kind of thing.
I'm an investor, a private investor.
I don't mean to be rude, but isn't that just a nicer way of saying venture capitalist?
No, it's a grown-up way of saying I'm excited by big ideas.
And money, presumably.
No, money's not the point. Money's a byproduct that enables me to keep doing what I love.
Which is what?
Helping brilliant people do brilliant things. Speaking of which, congratulations on winning this treasure hunt thing, which you just did, obviously.
Thank you.
By a long way. Days, actually. Do you have any idea how many people took part?
Nope.
Guess.
12.
17,000, give or take. And that includes teams from Oxford and Stanford, crypto security freaks, obsessives, hobbyists, nut jobs. And here you are.
Jen, I mean, there's a lot of money has been thrown at this because it looks great.
Yeah, it's more Bourne than Bond. I think the flavour is it's rougher around the edges. But I do always wonder what is going on with Niamh Algar's character, as in how during that space between her being a cryptic crossword nerd to becoming this almost action hero, where did she learn all those skills? You don't really get to see that. So it would have been nice to invest a little bit more time in her character for that. But I think the Charlie Big Potatoes of this show is Tom Hollander. He can deliver, as Chris was saying, ridiculous lines just with aplomb, but he's so funny. And I think people who are familiar with The Thick of It will know his deranged range in with a character from The Thick of It I can't even say the name of on this programme, just in case for sensitive ears. But he's great at being on the very edge, a man on the edge. And he holds your attention here. And it's the chemistry between him and Niamh Algar that work, that keep you watching, even though everything around them is utter and complete nonsense.
Okay, give me some stars.
I'll give it 2.5 for the performances.
Okay, Chris.
Yeah, I just found it all a bit choppy, totally contrived, full of lines that sound kind of cool, like the computer has thought things that have yet to be thought, but if you actually write that down you realise that doesn't make any sense whatsoever. But again, Hollander gets away with it. I wish Cross had told the story in a straight line. I think I would have been patient enough, like, because there are good ideas there, and we shouldn't, I don't want to laugh, we shouldn't laugh at big ideas. We need big ideas like this. It's just the execution that I had a problem with. So good performances, but I struggled with the show. So 2.5 out of 5.
Okay, next up, it's the BBC adaptation of Ronan Hessian's award winning novel Leonard and Hungry Paul. It is set in suburban Dublin and stars Alex Lawther and Laurie Kinnaston as the two friends in the title. Chris, this series is the day to the Iris Affair's night, isn't it?
It really is. Not everything needs to be complicated. Not everything needs to be even thrilling all the time. I mean, there's so much kind of genre-bending, heart-pounding, heart-hitting television. It's kind of, it's so strange that when something is gentle and as uplifting and as just as lovely as this comes along, there is a part of your brain that kind of goes, what is this? And where's the catch? And when is something bad going to happen? And that's not to say that bad things don't happen in this. I mean, this series, it is marked by tragedies, big and small and personal. But it's so quiet and it's so, surprisingly charming and just so ordinary. You know, it's about ordinary people and ordinary problems. It's about the comfort of routine and it's about male friendship. And it tells the story of a guy named Leonard, who is 32 years old. He's played by British actor Alex Lawther, sporting an impeccable South Dublin accent. I mean, there were times where I was thinking to myself, who is this guy? I was forgetting that it was Alex Lawther. I've seen him in so many other things, but I just thought for a minute, this must be an Irish actor that I've completely forgotten about. But he's playing a guy named Leonard, who is just a good egg with a good heart, an overactive imagination, and just this huge love for his mother, played by Emilia Crowley. And they live together at the very beginning of the story. And, they have this perfect relationship. And, you know, Julia Roberts' narration, which we'll come back to, kind of suggests that, yes, it might be a bit strange that he's a grown man living with his mother, but they're friends. They're just the best friends in the world, and they don't really plan for a life without one another, but unfortunately, you know, changes do occur and familial heartbreak is inevitable. And when she dies, he's left with this big kind of hole in his universe. He's thinking to himself, who am I without my mother? What do I do now? What's next? He takes, you know, comfort in, you know, the board game nights with his friend Hungry Paul. Hungry Paul is a name that is never explained, and you know what? I'm okay with that. And we're introduced to this other character down the road, where you basically got these two guys in their 30s who live very small lives, and they're okay with that. But when those lives actually start to open up, they're nervous because they've never really kind of, you know, known a life outside of this small little world that they have.
And Jen, one of the ways it starts to open up is Jamie Lee O'Donnell. She plays Shelley. She works Leonard's office. What did you make of her?
Yeah, I think she's great. I actually think the performances across the board here are sensational. I think with somebody like Leonard, he's someone we never get to see on TV other than as a punchline or as this oddball character. And he's not relegated to being, you know, this symbolic archetype or a best friend. He is the protagonist of his story. And I think there's something very moving about being invited into Leonard's life, and something that has become a structure. It's become a routine almost by accident. There's a comfort and safety in this everyday mundanity to his life, and life is happening to Leonard in this very passive way. And it's not about dramatically shaking yourself out of your confines or your environment. It's a story that it's not about the turn your life around kind of cliche. It's more about what happens when people fall into the trap of maybe easeful neglect of their lives. And I think he's confronted with Shelley in his office. And not to say that Jamie Lee O'Donnell's character is completely vibrant or over the top. It's not. It's just there's something about how she lives her life and the zest that she has for her world that attracts Leonard. And there's a good basis of chemistry between the two of them that's very believable. It's gentle. The conversations are relatable and they have that level of truth to them that it doesn't feel like they're opposites attract or they're too far away from each other to actually meet in the middle. And I think that's done really well.
This is the first time they meet each other. Leonard is at work. The fire alarm goes off and the office fire warden, who is Shelley, played by Jamie Lee O'Donnell, approaches him.
Fire! You have to get out of here. Run for your life!
Is it a fire or a fire drill?
I'm actually not allowed to answer that question. And even if I was, it doesn't really matter. You still have to get out of here. That was the rules, partner.
I'm okay. I'll take my chances.
Oh, no. I see you've left me no alternative. I'm going to have to pull rank on you. They don't give this sash to just anybody, you know. I had to complete an in-service course that lasted nearly an hour.
Fine.
Thank you. Let's go. Thank you. Yep, everyone, let's go. Thanks. Yep.
Chris, there will be people who will not be used to the pace of this and who may at some point say to themselves, well, when does this all kick off? They do need to bear with it because this is just the story and this is how it tells itself out.
Yeah, I mentioned earlier that you do ask yourself at the beginning, what's the catch here? You're waiting for the complication. You may be waiting for a bad guy, and Paul Reed's A Horrible Boss is the closest this series has to a bad guy.
He's just an irritation.
I think that's exactly what he is. Leonard is a ghostwriter of children's encyclopedias, and he has all of these wonderful stories inside of him. But you know, he's got this slippery, sleazy boss who just takes all the credit for them. And yeah, I suppose there is kind of a quality to Paul Reed's character as well, where it's just like I think by the end of the series, he might have redeemed himself too. It is very gentle. It is very charming. It doesn't get complicated, and that's fine. And I think a lot of people will be talking about who's narrating it. I mentioned Julia Roberts earlier. It's the Julia Roberts. It's so sweet that she actually got in touch with the author, Ronan, to let him know that she was a fan of this novel. And then when this series was being developed, the producers then got in touch with Julia, basically chancing their arm and saying, would you like to narrate this? And she jumped at it, which is nice. My worry going into it was that this narration might overpower things, or that it could just be phoned in, you know, because like both would be disastrous for it. But I think it's just perfect. It's a lovely little bonus. Her voice is so warm, so natural, so charming. It never takes away from the story. It's what it's doing is Leonard isn't always capable to kind of, you know, say what's on his mind. And that's to the characters and that's to the audience too. So Julia just comes in with that magic, golden, you know, Hollywood touch to just kind of bring sort of like a fairy tale quality to Leonard's thoughts. And it works brilliantly.
And there are a lot of those lines that come directly from Ronan Hession's original novel. Now that you've mentioned Paul Reed, who does play the boss, Mark, I think we have a moment of him and this is worth playing. So this is Leonard getting a visit from his boss, Mark Baxter.
Lenny, how was the weekend?
Not great, really.
Actually, my mother, sadly.
Hi.
She new? I think she's new. Anyway, yes, I just stopped by to see how our book is coming along. Yeah,
actually, great. I think it's going really well.
Excellent. That's what I like to hear.
If you like,
is definitely new.
Yeah, I think they moved some people down on the third floor.
She's new to me. Anyway, yes, I was hoping we could deliver by Friday.
That won't be easy. I thought we had to end the month.
We did, only I need to get this out of the way before the team building weekend.
I don't know. It's not a great time for me.
You? No, it's not for you. It's only for the interns.
Didn't know we had interns.
Yeah, sure we do. Well, we have one, Libby.
So it's going to be just you and Libby on a team building weekend?
Yeah, I thought she could benefit from some one-on-one time. You see, the thing is,
she's new.
Bingo! Right, gotta go, Lenny. Listen, Lenny, you're the best. The best!
We all know a Mark, don't we? In some office. Jen, we shouldn't leave out Hungry Paul's parents either. They're played by Lorcan Cranach and by Helen Bean. And those scenes between them are lovely and warm and sweet, and they fit in with the rest of
it's a love story at the end of the day. It's about, you know, Leonard's love for his mother, but it's about the love that he sees in the home of his friend Hungry Paul and how that touches him, and he wonders about his own life. Can he have that quality in his life too? Is he ready to embark on a relationship? Is Shelley the person that he will do this with? And seeing them as an example, they're brilliant, very lived in couple that you see with, you know, Hungry Paul's dad, played by Lorcan Cranach, that he still wants to impress his wife, played brilliantly by Helen Bean. They're two outstanding performances, by learning off the answers to a quiz show, and then when it's repeated he'll parrot them so he makes him look more intelligent, and she knows exactly what he's up to. But it's a gorgeous little identifier to show that ease between this couple, the gentleness, the happiness that their marriage is, and all of that coming back to Leonard about what that means in his life and his world, and about opening up his small world to something else.
Chris, visually, when I was watching it, there's almost an element of Wes Anderson kind of set design in their houses, and you know, you can see the Milky Way in the sky above Dublin when they go out. Is that charming, or did that get in the way for you?
Yeah, well, I hope people don't hear Wes Anderson and go, "Oh, well, this is too quirky." I don't think it is too quirky at all, because I did worry about that at the beginning. All of the colours, and also this kind of leafy corner of Dublin, which, you know, those places do exist, but where the sun shines all the time—that's probably the most far-fetched thing about it. I think it works perfectly with the tone. It's not a case where, oh, this show looks a little bit, you know, too ridiculous. I think it just fits the coziness and the comfort of the setup. It's not over the top like Wes Anderson films can be. It's perfect.
And also, there is, like, people might think, oh, this is twee. Yeah, but it's shot through with this melancholy that makes it something that's really worth watching. There is obviously this heart to it, but it's that melancholy edge to it that keeps you observing these characters and wanting to know more about them. I mean, Hungry Paul and Leonard are a bit like an edgeless, you know, Mark and Jez in Peep Show in a way. You feel that for them. There's this arrested development. There's like a stagnation to their lives that maybe could err on the side of resentful. And you want to see that, how that develops and how they deal with it.
Okay, stars from you?
I think I want Sarah Jessica Parker to narrate my life if she's out there and she wants to narrate my inner thoughts. That'd be great. I think Julia Roberts' narration is great. I think it sets it up perfectly. I think I was lost to this world. I thought it was beautifully done with characters that we never see on TV as protagonists. And I think more power to them, because there's too many chaotic TV shows out there. It's a gorgeous moment of, I don't know, just so enjoyable. Mm. A moment of reprieve on TV. It's like exhaling, which I really enjoyed. Yeah. 4 out of 5.
Okay, Chris?
I just thought it's a beautiful little show about quiet people and the things that we do to, you know, keep the soul ticking over, to keep the heart happy. And I just think it has more to say about life than Charity Big Potatoes. Like, just leave that in the corner. It's wonderful. 4 stars.
Okay, Alex Lothar was talking to me on last night's programme about Leonard, his Irish family and his love for cheese toasties in Grogan's. And you can listen back to that wherever you get your podcasts. Finally, a new 5-part docuseries about filmmaker Martin Scorsese has arrived on Apple TV. It's directed by Rebecca Miller. Jen, what are we covering here? Everything?
Everything. Okay. And like, I think it's really important that we are covering everything, because I don't want to be this person, but this year we've lost David Lynch, we've lost Diane Keaton, we've lost Robert Redford. We're so conscious of the fact that, unfortunately, we're losing that connection to what those greats are, what the film industry was, and we need to preserve these stories. And Martin Scorsese is all about the preservation of stories and storytelling. So it's only right that he gets 5 full hours of everything from minute one. From Rebecca Miller actually said the first interview she did with Martin Scorsese for this went on for 4 hours, and they'd only reached to age 13 in those 4 hours. And I was like, get me it. I want everything. Like, I don't want this edited. But so you're getting it all. You're getting the range here. And it also, I know everybody would be like, look, we know the stories from behind the scenes of Raging Bull. We know the stories from Taxi Driver or Goodfellas. But I think what Rebecca Miller does is there's this through line, there's this pattern through it about who he is as a person, what he wants out of film, what he gets out of cinema, what storytelling does to him, and this twin obsession. There is a part in it where he's talking about his films of the 80s. I think episode 3 is you could have that as a standalone film in itself, because it's about failure. It's about, after the success of Mean Streets, after Taxi Driver changed the world, what happens then? And it's about how he dealt with maybe not being accepted. He is the eternal outsider, and he has to remain the outsider in some ways. And being garlanded by Hollywood maybe didn't do him any favours. And it's about dissecting that, but also it's about, because if he had these failures with New York, New York, which was this massive, with Liza Minnelli, this massive production that just failed, completely failed, he wasn't allowed to make his passion projects, which were The Last Temptation of Christ and Gangs of New York. And they, for me, are the two main focuses. They are his thesis of life. So one about faith and what faith does to a person and blind belief. And then the other about home and what it means, the bloodshed that society, you'll go through in society to stake your claim and cause somewhere your home. And I think that's incredible to get this within just one episode of five parts. Mm. It's unbelievable.
Okay, I want to take something from it. This is Martin Scorsese talking about the time when he had no place to live. And so he moves in with Robbie Robertson from the band, and the two of them took drugs and watched movies all day.
It was, geez, I'm kind of tired. You know, we have a little bump or something, it'll just perk us up. Some people have an espresso.
We were trying to find something. We'll find the muse again, I guess. The joke is always, it makes me work better. Meantime, you're dead. You see, that problem is that you enjoy the sin. That's the problem I've always had. I enjoy it. I enjoyed when I was bad. I enjoyed a lot of it.
Because, Chris, it's kind of important about this series. There are a lot of those kinds of stories that maybe people don't know or have never heard before that stretch all the way back to his childhood.
That's what made it for me, to be honest. I did not know that Scorsese, before deciding on a career in filmmaking, studied to be a priest. I didn't know that his asthma was so bad as a kid that he had to stay indoors. He'd sit by the window. He'd frame New York from his apartment window, almost as if he was making films in his head. And he spent most of his time in, you know, New York city theater houses because they had great air conditioning, which helped him to breathe. It's all of these stories. Like, I didn't even know how badly received The King of Comedy was, because you just look at it now and you go, it's a terrific film. But that people were talking about the fact that, you know, will he make another great film again? That this was all news to me. And the reason I'm listing all of these things I didn't know about Scorsese that I now know having watched the series is because I think the mark of any good documentary series is not just to entertain viewers who might have an interest in this particular subject, but also to educate them. And in that regard, I think Rebecca Miller's series just knocks it out of the park, but also in every regard, because there were times during this magnificent series where I just started talking to the television, which is so unusual. And I usually...
Okay, Travis Bickle.
That's what I was going to say. I know I'm starting to sound like a certain Travis. But Martin Scorsese, when he's telling you his life story, when he was telling Rebecca Miller his life story, there were times where I just thought, this is an audience for one. It's like he's sitting down. It's like the goal is just, let's make this as intimate as possible. I've pulled up a chair with Marty, and whatever you want to know, the same way you would talk to a friend or a family member, you are going to learn from this. And that is an incredible achievement, to get that out of a filmmaker as legendary as Scorsese. I mean, there's been other films that have used the work of directors to chart, you know, a filmmaker's life. You know, where were they during this period? What were they thinking? What does this film say about that particular moment in their life? But there's never been one as engrossing and as charming and as just as informative as this one.
Okay, we're going to have to go for stars. Stars?
It's magic. It's just, it's 5 hours of Scorsese letting you in on everything, his family, his career, and it's all of his collaborators. And it gets to a point too where everyone starts finishing each other's sentences. Brilliant, unmissable, 5 stars.
Okay, Jen.
I think there's a point in it where Robert De Niro kind of brings him back from the brink, giving him Raging Bull, the story of Raging Bull. And it's about friendship and brotherhood and the bonds of understanding that keep you afloat in life. But also, you have to keep the conversation going. It's about conversing to create and how you have to keep listening and being out in the world. And I think the series, it digs into that responsibility, the tenets of cinema that are lost or are reduced to just mega corporations. But he is all about, you know, investing in preserving the voice. And I think this is exactly that. And I would have watched, you know, happily spent another 10 hours in his company. So 5 out of 5.
Okay, that's the first one of those for both of you in a really long time. Thank you, Chris Wasser and Jen Gannon. You'll find The Iris Affair on Sky or Now TV and Mr. Scorsese on Apple TV. And you can watch episodes 1 and 2 of Leonard and Hungry Paul on BBC One tonight from 9 o'clock. And welcome back to Friday Night's Arena. There's just 1 week to go now before the winner of the RTE Short Story Competition 2025 in honour of Francis McManus will be announced live here on Arena. Next Friday night, we'll be coming to you from the Pavilion Theatre in Dún Laoghaire, where there'll be live music performed by Choice Music Prize nominee David Kitt. Chosen from over 2,000 entries, there are just 10 stories on the shortlist for this year's competition, which is a long-standing literary event leading to the launch of many authors' careers. At the Pavilion, there'll be live readings of the selected short stories from a cast, including celebrated actors Katrina Nivoruku and Andrew Bennett. Also joining us on the night will be our panel of judges, Belfast-based writer Jan Carson, Derry novelist Neil Hegarty, and author and broadcaster Tristan Rosenstock, who'll be sharing their insights into the art of the short story and then announcing the top prizes, including the first prize of €5,000. So you can tune into Arena next Friday evening at the usual time for the RTE Short Story Competition Awards, or if you'd like to come along and be part of the whole atmosphere of this very special event, come along and be part of the audience at the Pavilion Theatre. The tickets are available at pavilionthatre.ie. And just a reminder, you can hear one shortlisted story every night on Late Date at 11:20 here on RTE Radio 1, and read or listen to all of the stories by going to rte.ie/writing and rte.ie/culture. Now, we finish off the week, as always, with this week's new albums. London-based five-piece The Last Dinner Party. I have a second album out today from The Pirates, produced by Marcus Dravs. It's cough time. I'm going to have to cough. Oh, I managed to make it through most of the week without a cough. excuse me. And follows their 2024 debut album, Prelude to Ecstasy, which earned them critical acclaim and a Mercury Music Prize nomination. Almost. This is awful.
Almost. But you're making me want to cough.
Would you fill for a minute, Kate?
I will, of course. You're getting The Last Dinner Party. It's from The Pyre. Myself and John Maher are here to review.
That's much shorter than the one I was going to have a go at. Their new record continues their mix of art, pop and rock influences while expanding on sounds and themes. Chrissy Hynde of the Pretenders returns with a solo album. It's called Chrissy Hynde and Pals Duet Special. It's an album of classic songs reimagined as collaborations with a wide range of guest artists, including Katie Lang, Mark Lanigan, Rufus Wainwright, Julian Lennon, Debbie Harry and Shirley Manson. The album pairs her vocals with some of the most recognisable ones in music. And finally, Scottish five-piece Brogale released their debut album Tuesday Paper Club. The band have been building a strong following through extensive touring, drawing comparisons to recent punk folk revival led by acts like the Mary Wallopers. And I'm joined now by Kate Brennan-Harding and John Maher. We're going to start with The Last Dinner Party. Kate, maybe you'd start with an outline of who they are and give us your thoughts as to whether or not From the Pyre manages to move them on from the early hype, and do they avoid the whole second album syndrome?
I'm not sure if they've avoided the entire second album syndrome, and I am talking as a massive fan of the five piece. They came about incredibly quickly. I mean, within 8 months they were supporting the Rolling Stones. They had an album out that just came out last year, was Prelude to Success. Prelude to Success. And basically, before all of that, they were playing Electric Picnic. I saw them at Electric Picnic and I was blown away. And industry people were saying, come and see them. And they were right to do that. So I was a massive fan. When I started listening to this album, I was straight away brought in with the opening album, or the opening track, which is Agnes Day. And the reason that I liked it so much, it was carried on what they had done before. With they've kind of got ABBA-esque vocals, they've kind of got melody, they've got glam rock, they wear their influences on their sleeves, but they do it with aplomb and this kind of mystic witches sensibility. What I will say is I've really enjoyed the album, but I am not as happy as I think I would have been if it wasn't so densely packed with too much guitar.
Okay, well, before we do anything else then, let's have a listen to that. This is the opening track from The Pyre, and it's called Agnes Day. And that's The Last Dinner Party, and that's Agnes Day from the album. John, the band have been known for their theatricality, sound, image, performance, all of it kind of coming together. How does that play out on this album for
you? I think it plays out well. I really like this album, and I loved the first album, Prelude to Ecstasy. For me, there's something of a continuation here, because James Ford, who produced the last album, co-wrote several of these songs. He was diagnosed with leukemia. He was set to produce this album. Marcus Draves stepped in. People will know him from work with huge bands like Coldplay, for instance. I think there is a lot of that baroque pop that's been there before, and maybe they're trying something slightly different this time around. I quite like it. I disagree with Kate, and this is unusual for us. We normally agree in a lot, but there was a lot that grabbed me on this album, and I certainly feel that it one could say maybe it doesn't advance hugely on what they did before, but I think what they did before was so good.
You see, and like I think you're right. I do agree with you on so many of the points, and it's interesting. I've written in around James Ford, didn't realise he got sick, because I think what my big problem is how absolutely they have ripped off Arctic Monkeys to the point of it's too on the nose. Do you know, there's two tracks where it's just, you could actually play some Arctic Monkeys song from AM beside it, and it's almost melodically identical and identical with the beat. So there's something around the originality that's annoying me, because yeah. I do love them.
Why do you think that is, Kate?
Well, obviously, if they've written some of the album with James Ford, he is a prolific producer and he was working with Arctic Monkeys. I just hadn't gotten as far as connecting that dot there. And I think as well, it's a classic sound. It's the album's from AM was from 2012. And I think they've always had that kind of Gretchen guitar kind of pulsation kind of beat. But there's just two tracks on it. They're brilliant tracks. I really enjoyed them. One of the tracks is Count the Ways, and the other track is is the lead single, which has just completely gone out of my head. Because my notes are funny there. Oh yeah, this is The Killer Speaking, brilliant lead single from the album. But they're so on the nose of Arctic Monkeys. That's what's annoying me.
I genuinely don't think that's an issue though. And yes, you know, I was thinking that to a degree, partly because of the producers that are involved. But there's something about this band that just, it feels quite unique in many respects. Mm-hmm. And you know, Abigail Morris is a very interesting vocalist.
Her staccato.
Yeah, it really is. And there were moments that grabbed me. Perhaps it took a little bit more than with the first album, which came out only 18 months ago. Mm. And that just felt like, wow, who are these? They feel so complete. And as you say, you know, they were supporting the Stones within months and Mercury nominated and all that kind of stuff. Whereas this, I think the listener, we have to try that little bit harder. Mm. But I think it's worth it.
Okay, I want to take something else from the album. Let's take a little bit of this. It's called Second Best. And that's Last Dinner Party, Second Best. Kate, do you think the gap between the two albums is a problem, given that it's such a short period of time? Should they have waited a little bit longer?
No, not at all. I think it's important as well when bands have momentum like that to continue and release. If we were to say that they should slow down, then we wouldn't have Fontaine's DC's fourth album only a year ago. John and myself were just saying, you know, he's saying that he loves it, and I agree. I do. I'll say about myself, I don't think I've given it enough time or I've been patient enough, because I think my expectations were too high. Mm-hmm. So I'm still going to give the stars that I'm giving it, and I'm still disappointed right now, but I might change my mind in a couple of months.
And what are those stars?
The stars are 3 out of 5.
Okay, John?
I think it's a very solid 4 out of 5. And by the way, they played at 3 Arena, which is such a huge venue for a band like this, on November 14, and I will be there.
Okay. Oh, I will be there too.
Album 2 tonight is Chrissie Hynde and Pals. It's called Duet Special. The album brings together a remarkable range of voices from K.D. Lang, Rufus Wainwright, Debbie Harry, Brandon Flowers. John, these sorts of albums are nothing new. What did you make of this?
I liked it to a degree. She has form on this. 4 years ago, she released the Bob Dylan covers album that was a revelation, because he has been covered so much and she found something new to do here. For me, there are some very special moments on this album, but also tracks that don't necessarily work, even though she, as you say, has assembled a remarkable cast of guest musicians. There is a decision that she takes that you want to reinvent these songs in a kind of slow tempo to really get to the heart of the lyrics. And for some of the material, that works really well. For others, you're just going, no, I want the original.
I want to take this just to begin with, because I think it's well worth a listen. This is the version on the album of Dolphins. John, you liked that one in particular on this album, didn't you?
Yeah, absolutely gorgeous. I mean, Chrissie Hynde has talked about Tim Buckley as an influence to her when she was growing up in the 70s. And I just love Dave Gahan's contribution here. Mm. I mean, you know, a huge Depeche Mode fan anyway, but just to hear him in maybe outside his comfort zone, I think this is the kind of cover that works beautifully, when artists are doing something that pushes themselves a little, but also offers some kind of reinvention of source material, and it works beautifully there.
Okay, Kate, what did you make of the album in general, and what stands out for you?
Well, in general, I really, really enjoyed it. And what I enjoyed about it is it's one of those things where, you know, if an old friend you haven't seen, someone that you're best pals with, but you haven't seen them in a long time, and they arrive over to your house, they've got new stories to tell you, or stories that you go over in an old way. And there's something kind of homely about this album, and how it's a collection of beautiful songs, songs that go back as far as 1940s. And it's a collection then of artists that she has weaved in. Like, there's a track, obviously Rufus Wainwright appears on it, and it's a beautiful version of Presley's Can't Help Falling in Love with You. Then there's, that's what Mark Lanigan is always on my mind, at Rufus Wainwright. I love Brandon Flowers appears on it, and Brandon Flowers, and he from The Killers, and he's singing a 10cc's track, I'm Not in Love, and it is a beautiful rework of the song. And also Brandon has such a fantastic voice, and an immediately recognisable voice with The Killers, and I thought on this he wasn't as recognisable, and he plays the kind of gentler role. It's like a gentler role to Hines' kind of more powerful vocal.
Yeah, it's a good point. In fact, his evolution as a musician has been a joy to behold. He's a great frontman as well. I think there were moments that just didn't work for me, though. And I like Morrissey's First of the Gang to Die is such a forward momentum song. There's so much energy in the original, and here it was rendered quite stately and restrained. And
I loved it for that.
Yeah, I didn't. It just felt too sluggish for me. And it features Cat Power, who I have huge time for. Really? And of all the musicians on this, she's the one that maybe most closely resembles Chrissy Hynde in her early Pretenders years. And it just doesn't work. And I think there are a number of songs here that just kind of fail to get out of first gear, but the ones that do are very special.
Mm. Okay, we'll have to get stars on this, John.
It's a 3 for me.
Okay, Kate?
This is a love story to music. I think it's 4 out of 5 for me.
Okay, we will take a break and we'll see what we make of the Brogale album after this. And it's Friday Night's Arena. I'm with Kate Brennan-Harding and John Maher, who are finishing out our music reviews this week. Let's go for Brogale and for the Brogale album. Where am I going to go? Kate, I'm going to start with you. First of all, who are Brogale? Why will people have heard of them, and where do they fit?
Well, I don't know if many people will have heard of them, apart from people that were at maybe Whelan's in April this year, or people who have followed the Mary Wallopers as they've helped tour with them. They are a Scottish band. They're from Falkirk. They actually formed when they were in school, and they started a club night, which is in a place called Vicar Street, Vicarstown, and that's where the song comes from on the album. It's not our Vicar Street here. Very much interesting band. They've been together for 5-6 years. I think the drummer on it is phenomenal and holds the thing together. This is their debut album. It's Tuesday Paper Club. It is set in their hometown. It is very much genre blending, folk, rip-roaring elements of like Celtic fusion, to the point of there's some horse lips elements on that. That's for me. I love the horse lips. So there's parts that I think are brilliant, but it gets a little bit lost, but there's a nostalgia driven thing in it, in terms of it sounds exactly so. Some of the songs sound exactly like they've stepped straight out of the 90s, with the Laz, Cast, Shed 7, that kind of thing. Even an ode to Oasis in some parts. So I don't think they've developed their identity yet.
I'm interested in that, John. Do you think there's both that kind of nostalgia, which there obviously is in it, and then a different kind of nostalgia in the sound? I mean, they supported the Wolftones at Thomond Park. Does that mean that their music, you know, could appeal to a whole different generation of Wolftones fans?
I think so, and I think the Pogues have been in heavy rotation on this band. I mean, I think the ghost of Shane McGowan is features on several tracks here, particularly in terms of delivery. And one thing that really grabbed me, because some of the songs I didn't think worked, but even those that didn't, I thought they're going to sound so good live.
Yeah.
And they will be playing a number of dates here later this month, and I'm going to make sure to see them live, because there is that kind of infectious energy throughout this album.
Let's take something from them. This is Brogale. The album is Tuesday Paper Club, and this is Vicar Street Days. I'll never forget the Vicar Street Days. The years of the There's a little bit of the Proclaimers in there as well, just a smidge.
It's a Scottish accent.
But it's the drum beats and it's the staccato delivery
it is,
as well.
But I don't
you know?
Think that song does them. That is not the best song on the album and is not, I think, what's reflective of what the really good quality on the album is. There's a song called Go Home to Your Bed and it is poignant and lilting and really, really beautiful and stand out, stand alone. It stands head and shoulders above those tracks. And there's also a cover of The Lonesome Boatman, which will make you want to go into battle, which I know if you think of The Lonesome Boatman, you wouldn't think that, but it does make you want to go into battle.
And actually, Go Home to Your Tay, there's lyrics as well in Scots Gaelic, mm. which, you know, considering that CMAT's album, she's singing Osquelga for part of it. I mean, it's good to see these regional acts, you know, kind of embracing their roots.
Absolutely.
And it's certainly the case here.
Okay, I'm going to take a little bit. Look, because you both of you have mentioned it, let's just take a smidge of the other track that we have here, and it is Go Home to Your Bed. And unfortunately, that's all we can give you of that. But I did want to play it just as an illustration of that there are a lot of different things going on this album. So mm. Brogale's Tuesday Paper Club. Kate, stars?
It's getting 3.5 out of 5 for me.
Okay, John.
3 from me. Loads of promise here.
Okay, The Last Dinner Party have their second album. It is out today from The Pyre. Chrissy Hynde and Pals Duet Special and Brogale's Tuesday Paper Club are all out now as well. Before you go, I want to get both of your thoughts on the Mercury Prize winner last night, Sam Fender, particularly given that CMAT seemed to be a red hot favourite and Fontaines were in there as well. Kate, what did you make of that as a win?
As a winner, I certainly don't begrudge Sam Fender. I really enjoy what he's about. I think it was great that he was in his hometown. For me, Romance should have won. Also, FKA Twigs and Pulp and CMAT is a phenomenal year of music. And I think collectively, that's what we need to take away from it. Go listen to all the albums that were on that list.
John, your thoughts?
I love People Watching. I think I was delighted to see Sam Fender winning. I love Romance as well. And it would have been great to see an Irish winner after 34 years. There has yet to be an Irish winner. Brilliant shortlist, but the album is a masterpiece and I'm delighted for him.
Kate Brennan-Harding and John Marr, thanks for joining us on Arena tonight. And that is it for Arena for this week. Produced tonight by Sheila O'Callaghan. Paula Shields was our researcher. Broadcast coordinator was Ollie Hamilton. And sound supervision tonight was by Harry Bookless. That's it. I'm Rick O'Shea. I will see you all next week from 7 again here on RTE Radio 1 for another week of Arena. And don't forget, this night next week, we will have our live RTE short story competition in honour of Francis McManus ceremony. That's happening at the Pavilion Theatre in Dúnlaoire. Tickets on the Pavilion Theatre website, or of course you can just join us on the radio in the good old fashioned way. That's it for me. Have a lovely weekend. John Creedon is next.